Welcome to the Del Walmsley Radio Show. Del challenges the status quo, questions everything, and empowers you to return to your core beliefs to make your life better. If you're ready to hear the truth and get your roadmap to the lifestyle you really want, the next hour will change your life. And now, your host, self-made millionaire, national award-winning investor of the year, CEO and founder of Lifestyles Unlimited, Del Walmsley.
Welcome to Del Walmsley Radio Show, where the hype ends and the help begins. I'm your host, Del Walmsley, and as always, we're working on your financial freedom. Well, my friends, 3 days ago, we had a goal-setting workshop. And people had to decide, what is it I really want in life? And you have to ask yourself these questions on a periodic basis to start all over and come back to what it is you really want in life. Break it down to the basis of, you know, hey, I've got all this stuff in my life, this giant life full of stuff. What do I really want? Now, many of you have heard me tell the story probably many times about the pickle jar, but I think at a New Year's basis, we need to reroute to that story again, because I remember a preacher one time, he took over a church, and he started giving a sermon. And everybody applauded the sermon, thought it was really good. They congratulated him, but that's really a good sermon. Then the next Sunday, he gave the same sermon again. And they go, yeah, that's a really good sermon. And then the third week, he gave the same sermon again. And finally, the church elders pulled him aside one day and said, hey, do you realize you're giving the same sermon every day? You haven't changed it up in 3 weeks now. And he looks at them and says, yeah, and I'm going to keep giving it until you guys get it. That's the way I feel sometimes. I feel like I've been giving the same sermon for 26 years. And some of you get it, and bless your hearts and souls. Man, I'll tell you, like last night I spent some time with people. There's some great, great members of Lifestyles. I love them. And the accomplishments that they've made are incredible. The people are just kind and loving, good people. And then there's people that don't get it. They literally don't get it. There was somebody who's in the audience who, you know, asked a simple question. And I said, have you ever been to my seminar? He goes, yes. He was at the seminar. He didn't get it. Either didn't get it, didn't remember it or whatever. And so I answered his question. It wasn't a big deal. But I wonder how many people out there in life just don't get it. How many people have been given the wrong perspective in life, and wrong, you know, again, when you sit here and you condemn somebody by saying they're doing the wrong thing, that's not fair. They're doing a less than effective thing. They could do way more effective things. They're doing less than effective. And, you know, I have my issues. I'm blindsided on many things. I'm less than effective in many things in my life. And what's funny is that I don't get it. You know, no matter how many times people tell me, I don't get them. You're just blindsided to it. It's just not you. You've been programmed so tightly to look the other way, to think the other way, that you can't really change. It's difficult, very difficult. And then what happens is what one psychiatrist or psychologist said is that people can't really change very much. They can change a little over a long time. Think about a little bit, like I'm a lot softer than I was 26 years ago. My seminars are softer. My radio approach is softer. You know, you can be a little softer. You can be a little harder. You can change a little bit, but you're not really going to change a lot. People can change, on the other hand, a lot for a very short period of time. You see people go away to clinics to overcome alcoholism, and they completely stop. They change their lives. But then 6 months down the line, they're hooked again. They changed a lot for a very short period of time, right? But they couldn't sustain that. People do the same thing with diets. They start a diet at the beginning of the year. They diet harshly. They work out. They lose a lot of weight. But then it comes back. The reason that all these things come back is because you got the wrong rocks in the jar, man. The rocks are in there in the wrong order. And you always revert to the big rocks. So the question is, what are the big rocks in your life? Now, the pickle jar story is about the important thing being to get the big rocks in first, because life was filled with minutia. You know, you put in the big rocks, and I'll tell the story for those of you who haven't heard it before. A time management professor pulls out a pickle jar, a big giant pickle jar, and pulls out a box of rocks and fills it up with rocks and asks the students, hey, is this full? And the students all say yes. And then he says, no, not really. He pulls out a box of pebbles. He throws the pebbles in there, shakes them around, gets them to fall in between the big rocks. And he says, now is it full? And they go, of course it is. And he says, no. And then he pulls out a bucket of sand and puts sand in there and shakes it, and the sand fills up around the rocks and the pebbles. He says, now it's full, right? Right to the top. And everybody goes, yeah, now it's full. He goes, not quite. And he pulls out a pitcher of water and pours water into the jar, and it fills in around all of the rocks and pebbles and sand. And then he asks him, what is the, you know, message? What do you learn by this example? And, you know, the kids go, there's always more time. There's always more time in your day, in your life, if you just arrange everything correctly. And he goes, no. The moral of the story is you got to put the big rocks in first, because if you don't get the big rocks in first, they're not going to get in there, because your life is going to be filled with minutiae, right? Well, I'm taking the story one step further today. I'm talking about the fact, do you have the right rocks in the jar? Even if you made, you know, the choice to put the big rocks in first, what is somebody, when you were young, programmed your brain in a way that made it where you didn't recognize what the big rocks were? Or maybe you do recognize it, but they're just the wrong set of rocks. Then what happens? Then the big things in your life become your disasters. You know, the wonderful thing that I always tell people, the great thing about your life is that you're absolutely perfect. You're exactly what you want to be. If you wanted to be anything else, you'd change it. So if you want to be fat, it's because you want to be. You're not fat by chance. You didn't just wake up and got fat. You had to do a whole lot of work to get fat. You know, if you're poor, you're not poor by chance. You have to do a whole lot of stuff to stay poor. There's specifics. I'll give you an example. I made a mistake of going to the doctor one time into an emergency room place. And these little emergency clinics, they're like little shysters. And I went in, and they charged me $1,000 to be there, and then $110, $111 to get an x-ray, another $100 for the medication guy to come and give him medication. Just a bizarre combination of charges. I turned it over to my insurance wouldn't cover it. So I paid it. But there was one bill that came late, had no idea what it was. It was $107. And I didn't even know what it was. And so I just threw it on the pile, kind of sat around, didn't pay attention to it. My BS, it's my fault. And then one day, I paid it. But by that time, that clinic, these little Shylocks, they went out there and they sold that debt to a collection agency. So the collection agency contacted me and sent me a letter. I contacted them. I said, no, I've already paid this bill. And unbeknownst to me, these collection agencies, they try, there's like the first line of attack, they attack you. And then the second line of attack is they go after your credit report and they'll sell the debt to somebody else. So I told these people I already paid this thing. And they moved it to another credit agency. They sold it. They knew that it was paid. I'd proved to them it was paid, and they sold it. So somebody else. So in other words, they're getting some other agency that doesn't know that it's sold, getting them to pay them 10 cents, 1 cent on the dollar for the debt to try to collect it. And so now this other agency comes after me, and they hit my credit report. Well, I had an 800 and something credit report. I think it was like 810, 820, something like that. I think you can only go up to 850. And this one bill, unpaid, dropped my credit report to 600. And I'm like, oh my gosh, what the heck is going on? So I got a hold of this credit agency, and I sent them proof that I had already paid this bill, and they agreed that they would take it off. And then I went to the credit bureau and sent them the proof that I paid it. And I got my credit report back today. It's 800 again. Now, my point is, why does everybody have bad credit and not fix it? What we were talking about was the story about the rocks and about how you got to get the big rocks in the pickle jar first. But also, we came up with the concept that you got to get the right rocks in the pickle jar. And, you know, there's many, many right rocks. We're not trying to solve everybody's problems here today. We're talking today, let's talk about money for a second. How many people have been told that the right thing to do in life is to go to school? When I was at the age where you were thinking about going to college, they had these charts that if you had 1 year of college, on average, you'd make more money than the average person. And if you had a two-year degree, you'd make more money than that on average. If you had a four-year degree, you'd make more money than that. If you had a master's degree, you'd make more money than that. If you had a doctor's degree, you'd make even more money than that. It was like they made it sound like fact. They were using statistics to say, statistically, you'll do better. But, you know, when you're a young kid and you're growing up and your parents are, you know, beating on your head, they're making it sound like those are facts. They may be statistics, but they may at the same time not be facts. I look at this situation, and it came to my mind because I went to a party, and I met an interesting couple. He had been a dentist, owned a dentist practice. He and his wife had been married for 65 years or so. No, I think they were 65 years old, so they probably were married for 45 years or so. Nice couple, great couple. And they were really happy because they had just retired, and he had sold his practice. And they had moved down from, I think it was Indiana or something like that, to be with their children who lived here in Houston. There was somebody they knew here, and that's why they wanted to be here, to be closer to their grandkids, I believe would be the story. None of that's really relevant to the point I'm making, but it's just a little background, you know. So we're having this great conversation, and then, of course, I get into my business mode, which happens all the time, and I'm thinking, you know, let me ask you a question. How did you come to the value of your practice? What are the parameters? Is it X percent of capitalization rate against your net income, or is it multiples of your gross sales? Is it balance sheet liquidation? And, you know, we started talking, and the guy gave me his example. But then I came across, you know, the story he told me shocked me so much. It blew me away. It really did. And he said that he sold his practice for 1.5 years of income, of his net income. 1.5 years of his net income. And I thought to myself, that's really ridiculous. I would never sell one of my businesses for 1.5 years of my net income. You know, I take an apartment complex that I make $100,000 a year in profit, and I sell it, and I walk away with $4 million. I don't walk away with $150,000. And then you realize why a practice is only worth that. It's because it's not a business. It's a job. He sold his job to somebody else. So this started me thinking, and I went and I looked all this up, and interesting factoids. Dental practices are sold on, three different ways. The first way is called the asset-based evaluation. You figure out what all the assets are worth, the book value of everything, and you just sell them the practice. You sell them the physical practice. There could be some goodwill in there. In other words, you've already got a clientele. It's not guaranteed you're going to keep this person's clientele, because when Dennis Bob leaves, maybe all people that love Dennis Bob don't love Dennis Dick who bought it. So you just pay for the assets. You buy out their equipment. You buy out their location. You buy out their lease. Buy their building, whatever. The second way to evaluate it is market comparison valuation. It'd be like a CMA, comparative market evaluation. What are other practices in the area selling for? And so you sort of do a CMA on the deal, just like you do on a single family house. And then the third way is the income-based valuation, which is how we'd sell an apartment complex. You take your net income and you multiply it by some multiplier. So the interesting thing about this is I started looking this stuff up. This is just how warped I am as a human being, because I love numbers. But I looked up the average dentist makes between 158. I'm sorry, the average dentist makes $166,000 a year, and the median dentist makes $158,000. Top dentists make $187,000. The top 10% make $187,000. That's the top 10%. So then you go on and said, let's look at the economics of this decision. This is an amazingly strange set of economics. First of all, you had to go to school for 8 extra years. If you can make $100,000 a year in a job, and you went to school for 8 extra years, I'm sorry, you can make $150,000 a year as a job, you went to school for 8 extra years, the first 8 years of you working pays for your schooling, which is $1.2 million. Then I looked up the average dental debt, a dentist coming out of college, what is their average debt? Is $240,000, $241,000. So between lost income and expenses and debt, they're starting out $1,440,000 behind the ball. $1,441,000 behind the ball. Think about that. What is the economic viability to that? Well, that now you can make $150,000 a year. Then I looked up what practices did. And when I looked up practices, I found that the average practice makes, let's see here, what does the average practice make? Where did I find that? I had it here somewhere. Da, 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 da. Oh, there it is. The average practice nets around $500,000 a year, including the salary of the dentist. In other words, what the dentist takes home is about $500,000 a year. That's pretty good pay. So you're saying, look, I put up $1.4 million to be able to make $500,000 a year. Now that doesn't sound so bad. You really recoup, if you have a practice, you can recoup that $1.4 million in 3 years. So that's not as bad. That doesn't sound nearly as bad, right? But when we come back from the break, I'm going to talk about what he got for his practice, because it will blow your mind. It really will.
You're listening to the Del Walmsley Radio Show. Del will be right back with more life-changing principles in just a few minutes.
Successful Lifestyles Unlimited member retires in 10 months.
The hardest part for me was to drop off my son, go to a job that I absolutely hated for 5 years, but know that that was a sacrifice that I needed to make, and then only be able to get to spend 2 hours with him after school before he had to go back to bed. So that's why once we started and we joined Lifestyles, we said, okay, we have a roadmap. We know what we're gonna do. And then a month later, we find out we're pregnant with baby number 2, and we're like, okay, we gotta kick it up a notch. So that's how we were able to purchase 4 different properties and replace my income in 10 months, so that whenever I finished maternity leave, I didn't have to go back to work.
I think a couple weeks before she baby came out is when we closed on a fourplex, and that was enough for her not to have to go back to work.
Are you ready for your roadmap to real estate retirement? Attend the online free workshop, just like Carolina did. Register lifestylesunlimitedworkshop.com.
Welcome back to the Del Walmsley Radio Show. Today we're talking about getting the big rocks right. Not just getting the big rocks in first, but getting the big rocks right. And major life choices that are made for us at very early on that end up that after 40 or 50 years, you look back and go, boy, that was a bad decision. It didn't really pay off the way that I would have hoped it would. So we're talking about a guy I met that sold his dentist practice. And his statement to me was that he got 1.5 years worth of profit for the price, right? So if a practice, general practice, averages $500,000 a year, that would make it $750,000 he got for his practice, right? And that's his retirement. Now, I went and looked this stuff up, and there's actually a website called Dental Economics, where they teach you all the economics behind being a dentist and the dental practice. And I pulled this up about price. It says, currently the national average for price of a dentist practice is approximately 65% of past year's gross receipts. The rule of thumb, value can range from 50% of gross receipts up to 100, but generally its average is 65. Essentially, the local prevailing market will dictate the price. Therefore, price usually falls within 10% range of any variance of any market, local market. Net profits arguably should be a greater factor than gross sales. However, in pricing, net profit is generally secondary to the gross. First, the gross receipts number is easier and more apparent, and while the true adjusted net profit is not. In other words, in a dental practice, you know, it's a one-man show, maybe one man, three or four or five people staff. But the bottom line is that it's his business. So he's running everything he wants to run through it. How many Christmas parties, how many parties does he have, how much travel does he put on it? And he puts all that stuff down as business expenses, so you don't really know what his profit is. It says most practices have declined in economy. The market, essentially the banks and buyers, dictate that price is determined by the most recent year and revenues. So if the guy is declining when he decides to sell, his pricing gift board is declining also. It's not like I'm going to go back and say, what have you made over the last 10 years ago? What did you do for me today? And I'll give you what you're earning today as a valuation of some type. So it's interesting. So if this guy got $750,000, and I think about it and think back to, wait a minute, I've had people make that in a year in an apartment business. In a year, they make that much. And so this guy worked for 40 years, and that was his return on his investment. Not to mention 8 years of college, right? So, you know, let's say that you think that's okay. Hey, that's fine. The guy walks away with, you know, his 401k, and this $750,000, so let's say he's got $1 million, a little over $1 million. And you go, well, Dell, that's pretty good. You're right. Relative to what you have, that might be very good. But relative to what he could have done if he would have gotten involved with lifestyles, made the types of decisions lifestyles people made. I had a dentist that was a member. He ended up buying 3 apartment complexes. I don't know his profit. It's years ago. But he's making a heck of a lot of money, and he was also using the depreciation to cover his income or some portion of his income. Again, I don't have his actual facts, actual numbers. But I know he made more than $750,000. I know at least that much. Not to mention the cash flow he's making every single month from his apartments. Which, you know, in this situation here, the guy's making money off his business. You know, that's why it's 500, not 150. The 150 is his salary. The rest, the 350,000, is making money off of his business, right? So I asked him, why did he sell? Because I just had to get out of it. It was consuming me. I had to get out of it. I said, why didn't you just keep the practice and hire somebody to take your spot? And that, it just didn't even click to him. It was either I have to be in there doing it or it won't get done. And I tried to rationalize this, and I asked him, why didn't you just hire a dentist for $150,000 and put him in? He goes, well, I wouldn't be able to get away. I'd still be tied to the business. I go, what is tied to a business? A dentist either knows how to do dentistry or he doesn't. A dental hygienist knows how to do hygiene or doesn't. Your bookkeeper does your books and either they know how or they don't. What is going to go wrong? Yeah, you're going to go in there and you're going to follow up and you're going to look over things and decide, you know, hey, maybe we need to start doing this better or that better or whatever. You're going to follow your income statement, your balance sheet every month very closely to see that that's not getting out of line. But why do you need to be standing next to the chair the rest of your life or not? See, what I hate in life, and I run into it all the time, it drives me crazy, is I get it my way or I'm not doing it all. I'm taking my baseball bat and going home. There's so many people that just have to have it their way. I asked a guy the other day on the radio, I said, why did you try to go out and buy all these houses and try to go buy an apartment complex without any training or any help or any assistance? The guy hit me with an answer that blew me away. He said it was because I had the lack mentality instead of the abundance mentality, which meant I see the world in every dollar that I give away to somebody else to do something is a dollar I'm losing. as opposed to every dollar you're investing in someone else, you're leveraging yourself and your company further. Took me until I joined Lifestyles, I couldn't get over that because I really, really had the lack mentality. And we call it the zero-sum game mentality. Zero-sum game means that the only way a person can get a dollar is somebody else to lose a dollar. It's really like what the Democrats believe. The only way, they believe that there's this lack of everything, and that the only way that people at the bottom of the socioeconomic bracket can have more money is if you take it away from the people at the top. Instead of just creating more money for everybody, including the poor people, they just take it from the people that already have it. That's a lack mentality. It's a zero-sum game. They do it on everything. Like they're saying, now we're going to die because of the ozone layer and global warming. So they want to take away from the rich countries the ability to produce carbons. You're not going to stop the poor countries from doing it. They're not going to stop doing it. So you're given the carbon points. They had some kind of name for it. It was like carbon dollars, carbon points, something. Given the carbon points to the poor people, to the poor countries, and allowing them to do it so that they can build their economy up as strong as ours by using the same stuff that we use to build our economy. But we have to stop using it, right? When I was in grade school, I was interested in geology. So I took some geology courses. And I remember when I was in high school, they told us there was only 20 years of oil left. The world was coming to an end. There's a zero-sum game. So they wanted to ration oil, gasoline, and so forth, because we were going to run out. Now, there's like 1,000 years of oil available. Why? Because we learned how to drill sideways. Because we learned how to pressurize the wells, because we learned how to frack, because we found that there's oil in deep ocean, because we found there's oil in Alaska, there's oil in almost every country. And now there's so much oil that oil prices are cut in half. In fact, I don't know what the highest oil's ever been. I think it's probably $150 a barrel. Now it's down to 50. It's got down as low as 30. But according to these people, they still believe that we're running out of oil. 20 years. This is the stuff that just drives me crazy as I sit over here and I go, man, how many of these stupid rocks do I have in my jar? I wish you could go to a stupid rock dealer and let them tell you which rocks in your jar are stupid, just dumb as a rock. Don't make any sense at all. Perverse almost in belief systems. I sure would like to be able to go to the dumb as a rock store and have my rocks evaluated. Because it scares me, because I see other people's rocks that are so crazy, wrong, so wrong, that it just blows my mind. How can they not see that rock is flaming red hot with crazy? And yet that's their big rock. That's what's important to them. The lines are open. We have a caller on hold right now from Redwood, California. I believe the pronunciation is Higgy. Did I get that right, Higgy?
Yes, you did. Thank you so much, Del.
How can I help you today, sir?
Thank you. Thank you, and Happy New Year, and congratulations on fixing your credit report. I got the same kind of issue that I'm kind of, yeah, a pain in the butt, right?
Boy, that flipped me out, too, when it happened.
Oh, yeah. I went to go try to buy a new truck for the business, and they were giving me, like, some super high interest rates, and I had a house that we built out here in Redwood City, and the neighbor went kind of crazy on us, and, she sued us for $10,000, which is the maximum that she can actually sue in this county, and, just a complete extortionist. Anyways, I prepared all these slides and went to court, and she still won $800. I just couldn't believe it. But anyway,
what did she sue you for? I got it. Now you've piqued my interest. I've got to know. What did she sue you for?
So the original owner had a double lot, and she bought one parcel with a house, and then I bought the second parcel with a house there that we demoed and we built a new house. But there was never a fence that was put up. So I hired a surveyor when we first kind of went to do the project. I hired a surveyor, and I know exactly where the property line is. And so when we finished the project, we had to construct a fence. And at the initial, I told her, hey, let's go ahead and we'll split 50-50 for the fence. And then almost a couple weeks before we finished the project, she's coming up to me and she tells me, hey, you know, I don't have a lot of money. And, you know, can you go ahead and pay for the fence? And I'm a nice guy. You know, we've been working there for almost a year building this brand new house. And, you know, I said, okay, let's do it. You know, we'll go ahead and do it. And thinking that that was a good thing to do. Next thing you know, we chopped the first day we started actually chopping the trees down. She sends me an email telling me that these trees are like her favorite trees and how did we chop them down? And, you know, it made it like it was, you know, that she's praying to these trees for some reason. So you know, I replied back. I was so pissed off. I'm like, are you freaking nuts? You know, I'm paying for the trees, you know, I'm paying for the fence, and now you're worried about the trees. The trees were actually on my side, and one tree was actually on the property line. So, you know, push came to shove. She's like, you know, she files the claim in small claims court. I tried to settle with her five ways outside of court, hire a mediator, pay her some money. You know, an attorney, and she just kept dancing left and right, and she just wanted to go to small claims court. And we went to small claims court, and they had a pro tem judge, and the judge, I prepared 42 slides with evidence, and the judge, for some reason, still awarded her $800, and the judgment comes by mail. So, I mean, small claims court is the biggest freaking joke out in this area, but, that's kind of the way that I can counter sue her, but I just don't want to see her. I don't want to deal with it. I have another project that we're working on, and things are moving forward. But when I came to pull my credit and to buy a truck, they told me, "Hey, well, you have a judgment on you for $6,000." And I'm like, "It's completely inaccurate. It was already paid off. It was already settled. But you know, I feel your pain about this judgment. I got the same thing. I got to fix now." With the credit bureaus.
Yeah, you got to jump on it too, man. You got to prove it to them, get it done, get it all done the right way. Luckily, I was surprised because, like, right after I got it fixed, it took like 2 or 3 months for the credit reporting agencies to pick that up and take it the other direction. So I guess that the lady got her money because you cut down a tree that was half hers and half yours, is I guess what you're saying, if it was right on the property line. So
exactly. But then there's also something that was passed by Congress. It's called the Good Neighbors Fence Act, which states that it's the responsibility of both parties to maintain property lines. So if there's the surveyors where they leave the property marker or a fence that needs to be repaired, it's the both property owners' responsibility, and there's a special procedure to go about it. But it's called the Good Neighbor Fence Act that was passed by Congress. I'm not sure if that applies in Texas, but I believe in California it applies for all the people in California.
I think there's something like that. Yeah. I don't know what it's called. Yeah. I've never had to fight with it, but I think it is where the fence belongs to both people.
Yep. No, right on.
Interesting. Yeah. But, you know, I'm going to tell you something about those courts. Small claims court, as you're calling it, we call it a JP court here in Texas. Small claims courts are not a court of law. They're a court of justice. They're no different than those TV judges. You know, Judge Judy, whatever.
Yep.
It's the exact same thing. They can do whatever they want to do. There is no law. They do not have to follow the law. It's called a court of justice. They say whatever they think is right, that's what goes. So, you know, trying to win at that level is difficult if you're going to try to win on facts, because they're going to allow emotion into that, you know, the
oh, man.
Whole issue.
Oh, yeah. I got worked up. I mean, I got 42 slides I prepared with pictures and this and that, and I paid two surveyors. When we initially started the project, and then after the project, to show her again, these trees are not on your property. Only one tree was shared, and I don't owe you crap. And I told her, let me give you $400. She's like, no, you know, she wants more money. And she's again, it was just kind of, anyways, yeah, but it is a joke. Small claims court out here is a complete joke. I was surprised as well, because I thought, like what you said, again, he was going to go by the facts. and they pretty much went by break.
Yeah, they go by emotion. All right, Higgy, I appreciate your call. Thank you for calling in. I hope you get that thing straightened around for you as soon as possible, because it is a pain to have your credit messed up.
Thank you so much, Del.
Thank you much. Listen, folks, remember this. Let's get the big rocks in the jar first, because it's not money. It's a lifestyle we're trying to build.
The information and opinions you hear on the Del Walmsley Radio Show are those of the host, Del Walmsley, his guests, and his callers, and do not necessarily reflect the opinions of this station, its affiliates, its management, or advertisers. The Del Walmsley Show is for entertainment purposes only. Please consult a professional regarding your personal investment needs. Nothing presented on the Del Walmsley Show constitutes an endorsement, recommendation, offer, or solicitation to buy or sell any product or security.